You're listening to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your host, Alex P. Keaton. False. I'm Alex Linder. I'm with VNNForum.com. Today we're going to do some Francis Parker Yockey. We're going to look at what he says about Marxism. Now, like I say, you can find this and everything that I record at VNNForum.com. Also go to AlexLinder.net for a slightly different configuration of these audiobooks. Vargas set it up somewhat differently. If you can't download something at AlexLinder.com, then go to TheMassive at VNNForum.com and you can download the MP3. So there may be various problems with Flash for different people. Anyway, I'm not going to get too far into the technics, but the main body of it is at VNNForum.com. And let's get into it. All right, Yockey. We've made our way so far up through page 77 out of about 630 or so. And page 78, he takes up with Marxism. He says, although England was the nation which actualized the ideas of the early civilization phase of the West, the period 1750 to 1900, namely rationalism, materialism, capitalism, as they have the Industrial Revolution, and economies of scale and divided labor and such things, yet these ideas would have been actualized otherwise, even if England had been destroyed by some outer catastrophe. Nevertheless, for England, these ideas were instinctive. They were wordless, beyond definition, self-evident. For the other nations of Europe, they were things to which one had to adapt oneself. Capitalism is not an economic system, but a world outlook, or rather a part of a whole world outlook. And he's using an English or an Anglicization of Weltanschauung, something beyond mere perspective, but an entire outlook or way of perceiving the world, a world outlook. It is a way of thinking and feeling and living, and not a mere technique of economic planning, which anyone can understand. It is primarily ethical and social, and only secondarily economic. The economics of a nation is reflected, or is a reflection of the national soul, just as the way a man makes his living is a subordinate expression of his personality. Capitalism is an expression of individualism as a principle of life, the idea of every man for himself. It must be realized that this feeling is not universal human, but only a certain stage of a certain culture, a stage that in all essentials passed away with the First World War, 1914 to 1917. Or to 1919. And I should pause to say here, I don't agree with what he's just said, because men are always going to be individuals. They are. What he's trying to do is a reductionist, leftist, communist sort of, man is reducible to purely an organic member of a society, and this is ridiculous. Man is both a member of a collective and he's an individual, and market economics works better than planned economics. That has been proven time after time after time. The problem of planned economics is scarcity, and the problem of unplanned or privately planned economics is overproduction. Think about which one is worse. Capitalism gives you obese individuals with flat-screen TVs and all the technology they can handle. It's up to them to reform their character in order not to consume too much. And they are capable of doing that, the elite. The masses perhaps are not. But maybe the masses shouldn't exist so much, is another way of looking at it. Socialism is also an ethical social principle and not an economic program of some kind. It is antithetical to the individualism which produced capitalism. Its self-evident instinctive idea is each man for all. Again, Muzzy, and he's flat wrong about this, because people don't inherently feel part of something greater as a serious daily motivation, because they can hardly make it out. You can sell them into Christianity or some other system, something racial, whatever, but their individual lives and their individual interests will always be first in their mind, and there's no getting away from that. To individualism as a life principle, it was obvious that each man, in pursuing his own interests, was working for the good of all. To socialism as a life principle, it is equally obvious that a man working for himself alone is ipso facto, that by that fact, working against the good of all. The 19th century was the age of individualism. The 20th and 21st are the ages of socialism. Except the problem is, under most socialism, you're working for the good of the entrenched elite at the very top. And they may even claim to be racial, but in the end, they're out for themselves, and they're hindering what the individual man can do for his family. It's people who can produce lots of money, who can build large and successful families, who are then in positions of strength to aid their community. It's not masses of poor people who need to be regimented by a central government. If they are that weak and can't run their own lives, then how valuable are they in the first place? It's always funny how you're racial, you believe in survival of the fittest, you believe that life is a struggle, but all of a sudden this stops and you want to subsidize weakness and inferiority. And so this is the counter case to what he's saying. I'm not going to go into it too deeply because it's his book and he can... you can judge his ideas for yourself, but that's my view. They each have to bear their strength. What the individual can reasonably ask is if he desires to be part of this community rather than that, say a white racial community rather than a Christian community, or rather than a Jewish racist community where he's part of a nasty mix and essentially, as I've said, a butt bearing the burden. He's made the mocking stock of the newspapers, and he's made to bear the tax burden for the incompetent. That seems to me where he has a rational collective interest in being part of a different whole than the one he may have been born into, as we white men have been born into today's world. So my view is a man is both an individual and a member of a collective, and maybe multiple collectives. To some extent, he can choose among competing organizations or at least fight for the one he prefers. And that's what I take the white racial cause to be. And I think these people, Pierce included, go far too far when they say that all these other races are mentally and mutually incomprehensible to one another. I don't believe that. I believe they are allowing ideology to conform reality. They're conforming reality to their ideology when they go that far and say, oh, we totally can't understand what's in the mind of an Oriental or a Black. Yes, we can. They are different, but it's a matter of degree. It's not necessarily a matter of kind. If it's kind, it's biological, but we can darn sure understand what's going through their mind, and they can understand a lot of what's going through our mind. Maybe not the highest part, but on the lower part, certainly, in the way that dumb people can't really understand smart people, but smart people can understand dumb people to a much greater extent. Because to dumb people, smart people seems like magic or some kind of trickery to them. Dumb or average people believe in religion, which is the same thing as believing in luck or chance or the gods deciding your fate. Smarter people believe in cause and effect because they can observe it happening. And they feel the masters of their own lives. Thus, they're happier and more successful because they have more mental wherewithal and they have more will. So he says again, the 19th century was the age of individualism. The 20th and 21st are the ages of socialism. No one has understood if he thinks this is an ideological conflict. Ideology itself means the rationalizing of the world of action. This was the preoccupation of the early phase of the Western civilization, 1750 to 1900, but no longer engages the serious attention of ambitious men. Programs are mere ideals. They are inorganic, rationalized. Anyone can understand them. This age, however, is one of a struggle for power. Each participant wants the power in order to actualize himself, his inner idea, his soul. 1900 could not understand what Goethe meant when he said, in life, it is life itself that is important and not a result of life. The time has passed away in which men would die for an abstract program of improving the world. Men will always be willing to die, however, in order to be themselves. This is the distinction between an ideal and an idea. Marxism is an ideal. It does not take account of living ideas, but regards the world as a thing that can be planned on paper and then set up in actuality. Marx understood neither socialism nor capitalism as ethical world outlooks. His understanding of both was purely economic, and thus a misunderstanding. Except that we know from his letters that he was well aware, and he wrote to different people saying this is the cover behind which Jews are going to take over the world. Or if he didn't say that himself, he was at least aware of that type of thinking. Jews always present as universally true and valid ideas their systems, which are actually disguised systems for advancement of the Jewish race, one particular specific race. Oh, it's good for... No, it's just good for Jews. But they won't tell you that. The explanation Marxism offered of the significance of history was ludicrously simple, and in this very simplicity lay its charm and its strength. The whole of the history of the world was merely the record of the struggle of classes. Religion, philosophy, science, technics, music, painting, poetry, nobility, priesthood, emperor and pope, pope state, war and politics, all are simply reflections of economics. Not economics generally, but the struggle, quote, of classes, quote. The most amazing thing about this ideological picture is that it was ever put forward seriously or taken seriously. So again, we have Freud and Marx reducing everything to sex or money, and they're wrong, but because they're part of a powerful Jewish network, they are promoted beyond everything else and made the basis of revolutions, cultural or political. The 20th century finds it unnecessary to contradict this history picture as a world outlook. It has been supplanted and has joined Rousseau. The foundations of Marxism must, however, be shown, since the whole tendency which produced it is one that this age is impelled to deny as a premise of its own existence. Being inwardly alien to Western philosophy, Marx could not assimilate the ruling philosopher of his time, Hegel, and borrowed Hegel's method to formulate his own picture, just as the Jew Einstein ripped off various white men like Poincaré and others. Marx built his system off of a superior Aryan thinker, Hegel. Borrowed Hegel's method, in italics, to formulate his own picture. He applied this method to capitalism as a form of economy, in order to bring about a picture of the future corresponding to his own feelings and instincts. These instincts were negative toward the whole Western civilization. In other words, Marx was a Jew radical who wanted to destroy the West and put forward a pseudo-scientific, universally true doctrine as the basis for justifying what was a private racial hatred of the West, common to his race. Remember, Marx was from a long line of rabbis. But he was from a very intelligent man, there's no doubt about that. As I said, I saw his handwriting at his house, I think it was in Trier, microscopic, and there was a very strong proxy between the size of handwriting and intelligence. So he was intelligent, but he was also a fraud, like most Jews. Although he had interesting writings and some of his ideas were interesting, on the whole, destructive false idea that isn't true. We judge it the same way we judge Christianity. It isn't true. These instincts were negative toward the whole Western civilization. He belonged with the class warriors who appear at a corresponding stage of every culture as a protest against it. The driving force of class war is the will to annihilation of culture. The explanation Marxism offered of the significance of history was ludicrously... Oops. I already read, let me see here. The driving force of class war is the will to annihilation of culture. The ethical and social foundations of Marxism are capitalistic. It is the old Malthusian struggle again. Whereas to Hegel, the state was an idea, an organism with harmony in its parts. To Malthus and Marx, there was no state, but only a mass of self-interested individuals, groups, and classes. Capitalistically, all is economics. Self-interest means economics. Marx differed on this plane in no way from the non-class war theoreticians of capitalism, Mill, Ricardo, Paley, Spencer, Smith. To them all, life was economics, not culture. To them all, it was the war of group against group, class against class, individual against individual, whether they say so expressly or not. All believe in free trade and want no state interference in economic matters. None of them regard society or state as an organism. Capitalistic thinkers found no ethical fault with the destruction of groups and individuals by other groups and individuals, so long as the criminal law was not infringed. This was looked upon as, in a higher way, serving the good of all. Marxism is also capitalistic in this. Its ethics have superadded the Mosaic law of revenge and the idea that the competitor is evil morally, as well as economically injurious. The competitor of the working class was the bourgeoisie, and since the victory of the working class, in quotes, was the sole aim of the entire history of the world, naturally Marxism, being a philosophy of progress, ranged itself with the, quote, good, unquote, worker against the evil bourgeois. The necessity for thinking things are getting better all the time, a spiritual phenomenon which accompanies every materialism, was as indispensable to Marxism as it was to Darwinism and 19th century Philistinism generally. And that's an interesting idea. I have no critique of that. I don't know if it's true or not. Thinking things are getting better all the time is indispensable to Marxism, Darwinism, and Philistinism generally. Fourier, Cabet, Saint-Simon, Comte, Proudhon, Owen, these were the pre-scientific, if Marx was a scientific socialist, these were the utopian socialists who preceded him, all designed utopias like Marxism, but they neglected to make them inevitable, and they forgot to make hate the center of the system. They used reason, but Marxism is one more proof that hate is more effective. Even then, one of the older utopias, that of Marx, was the last in Europe, being followed only by Edward Bellamy's. And he wrote, Edward Bellamy wrote a book, I've read part of it, called Looking Backward, which is one of the top sellers, I think, of the late 1800s or early 1900s, about what life would be like in a couple of hundred years. Or I forgot exactly when he put it in the future, but it was one of those utopian, futuristic books, rather than the dystopian, but planted in the future. So he's saying what was unique about Marx is he made his inevitable and put hate at the center of it, compared with the utopian socialist who preceded him. This whole concept, which really Yaki seems to come down to in a lot of these people, is whether society actually is an organism. And they do not appear to understand that as a metaphor. They appear to believe it as an actual, I guess one would say, biological reality. I do have a problem with that. I don't know that it is an organism. I mean, it's there are webs of relationships, and some of these graphics we've seen in recent years showing that, you know, they'll show these companies and these other ones and the connections between them. To me, that's how it is. It's to call it one organism is kind of, it's not literally true, and I don't know that metaphorically it's that valid either. Society is kind of a barrier reef, maybe, in a way. There are lots of rooms and niches, and there's cooperation, but there's also competition within it. And there's some degree of choice involved, I think, much more than I think Yaki appears to believe. Anyway, so he just distinguished Marx there from the earlier utopian socialist. Marx was a scientific socialist. He held himself out as, although his system was in no way scientific and certainly was not verified by subsequent actions. Something scientific, you come up with a hypothesis that can be used, can be tested. And the minute it's found wrong, it has to be discarded, and it has no particular predictive power. So some other competing explanation is a better one. So he says, all those earlier ones all designed utopias like Marxism, but they neglected to make them inevitable, and they forgot to make hate the center of the system. They used reason. But Marxism is one more proof that hate is more effective. Even then, one of the older utopias, that of Marx was the last in Europe, being followed only by Edward Bellamy's in America, might have played the Marxian role, but they came from countries with lower industrial potential, Russia versus Germany, and thus Marx had a capitalistic superiority over them. All right, number two, Roman numeral two in his chapter on Marxism. His chapters are unnumbered. Excuse me. In the Marxian scheme, history got almost nowhere until the Western culture appeared, and its tempo accelerated infinitely precisely with the appearance of Marxism. The class war of 5,000 years was ready to be finally wound up, and history was to come to an end. The victory of the proletariat was to abolish classes, but it was also to dictate. A dictatorship of the proletariat implies someone to receive the dictate, but this is one of the mysteries of Marxism, which kept the conversation of disciples from flagging. And one thinks of all the Jews at CCNY, the City College of New York, sitting around with their egg salad sandwiches and drinking their egg cream sodas and yapping about. They literally had different tables where they subdivided the Marxists, and each Marxist splinter group had its own lunch table where they argued with their fellows. That's the type of culture Jews come from. That is what pill-pull means. Think about Goyish culture and how different it is, and you see how these intellectualizing Jews have come to dominate us through verbal trickery as much as anything else. Lies, black lies backed by red murder, let's say. By the time Marxism appears, there were, says the theory, only two classes left, proletariat and bourgeoisie. Naturally, they had to carry on war to the death, since the bourgeois was taking nearly all the proceeds of the economic system and were entitled to nothing. Au contraire, it was precisely the proletaire who were getting nothing who was entitled to everything. The reduction of classes to two was inevitable. All history had only existed in order to bring about this dichotomy, which would finally be liquidated by the dictate of the proletariat. Capitalism was the name given to the economic system whereby the wrong people were taking everything, leaving nothing for the right people. And you notice how this is mutated today, 70 years after he wrote this in 1948 or whatever, 60, 70, 80 years. Whites are the bad class, and blacks and Jews, etc., are the good class. And whites, the almost not even tacit anymore assumption is whites stole everything. Everything was pre-existing. Whites stole all the raw materials. They stole all the finished goods. Now, of course, that's a total contradiction. And everything was built on the back of blacks and other coloreds, and everything was stolen from them. All these mutually ridiculous ideas. They're contradictory and ridiculous, but they're held by people nonetheless. The reduction of classes to two was inevitable. All history had only existed in order to bring about this dichotomy, which would finally be liquidated by the dictate of the proletariat. Capitalism was the name given to the economic system whereby the wrong people were taking everything, leaving nothing for the right people. Capitalism created the proletariat by mechanical necessity, and equally mechanically, the proletariat was fated to swallow up its creator. What the form of the future was to be was not included in the system. The two catchwords, expropriation of the expropriators and dictatorship of the proletariat, are supposed to contain it. Except they didn't expropriate it, they developed it. Until someone comes along with the ability to see in something its potential and to actually bring it out, there is no job for anyone else. So he's not exploiting anyone else. He's offering them rather a possibility that did not exist before. And that they preferred that. If they preferred to stay on their farms, they could have, but they preferred to go to the city and work. Now, you can add in the money manipulation is certainly a fake part of that. That's true. But then that's not really the market. You can call it capitalism if you're disposed to dislike the market, but it's not a market mechanism when the government, this is the key part that white nationalists almost always get wrong. The point is not that the Federal Reserve is private. The point is that this monopoly cartel is empowered by the government. The government created the Federal Reserve. The point is not the Federal Reserve could not create itself. It had to act through Congress and the formal political structure. So don't tell me that the banks are the ones who have the true power. Congress didn't have to do that. It did. So the point is not that it's private, it's yet another government activity that's wrong. They don't allow competition. The marketing is not the problem. The problem is they don't allow competition in order that they can get by just printing money and not allow anyone to compete with them. So people throw around words, but it's important to look at the reality. Is there a market structure in place, or is there not a market? Or is the market being prevented from working, or is the market allowed to work? If the market in money is allowed to work, it will drive out the bad money. And the frauds and the liars and the people who don't have it will be driven out of business, and they'll only bring down the ones associated. But when you tie everyone together into one system and you don't allow any competition, you don't allow anything outside of that system, then when one goes down, everybody goes down. We all have to pay for the failures of everybody else. That's not how it's supposed to work. But it's easy to sell that to people when you say, we're all in this together, we're all in one organic whole. Well, that's a way for some of the smart criminals to use the dumbest and worst among us in order to justify their own predation. They steal from the middle class and feed the scum criminals the people who are incompetent at the bottom with endless social welfare in order to buy votes. And who gets screwed? The competent people in the middle. Actually, it was, of course, not even in theory a plan for the future, but simply and solely a theoretical foundation for class war, giving it an historical, ethical, and economic political rationale. This is shown by the fact that in the preface to the second Russian edition of the Communist Manifesto, a theory was put forth by Marx and Engels according to which communism would come directly from Russian peasantry to proletariat dictate without the long period of bourgeois domination which had been absolutely necessary in Europe. So the minute there are some favorable conditions appear, he reworks the theory to justify it. That's how scientific he is, not scientific at all, in other words. The important part of Marxism was its demand for active, constant, practical class war. The factory workers were selected as the instruments for this struggle for obvious reasons. They were concentrated, they were being mistreated, they could thus be agitated and organized into a revolutionary movement to realize the completely negative aims of the coterie of Marx. Remember what we heard about all the in the Ford audiobook that we did. The International Ladies Garment Workers and all these different unions in the Lower East Side of New York, where the matrix that provided the class that replaced the Russian Aryan, the Aryans ruling Russians, the Romanovs, with these Jewish radicals, and the piecework of these labor unions allowed them to pick up and put down, and they were flexible with their time so they could go off and attend these communist political meetings. The important part of Marxism was its demand for active, constant, practical class war. The factory workers were selected as the instruments for this struggle for obvious reasons. They were concentrated. They were being mistreated. They could thus be agitated and organized into a revolutionary movement to realize the completely negative aims of the coterie of Marx, that is, purely destructive. For this practical reason, hate finds its way into a picture of history and life. History and life capitalized. And for this reason, the bourgeois, simply mechanical parts of a mechanical evolution, according to Marx, are endowed with malice and evil. Hatred is useful in fomenting a war, which does not seem to be occurring of itself. And to the end of increasing hatred, Marx welcomed lost strikes, which created more hatred than successful ones. So Marx welcomed lost strikes. Only to serve. See, what actually happened was that the market so improved a lot of lives. And granted, there were unions who, together with management, created better conditions. But on the whole, what it was simply the evolution, the continual competition leading to improvement that raised the standard for everybody to where the lowest man on the planet practically was higher than the kings of old. Now, socialists will continue to deny that to this day, but that is the fact of the matter. It was these brilliant individuals who came up with new improvements that are the ultimate social welfare safety net for the rest of us. That's the truth. Only to serve this purpose of action are the absurd propositions about labor and value put forth. Marx understood journalism and had no scruple whatever about saying that the manual laborer is the only person who works who creates economic value. To this theory, the inventor, the discoverer, the manager are economic parasites. This is, of course, ridiculous. The fact is, of course, that the manual type of labor is merely a function of the value-creating, precedent, prerequisite labor of organizer, entrepreneur, administrator, inventor. Great theoretical importance was attached to the fact that a strike could stop an enterprise. However, as a philosopher said, even a sheep could do that if it fell into the machinery. Marxism, in the interest of simplification, denied even a subsidiary value to the work of the creators. It had no value. Only manual labor had value. Marx understood propaganda long before Lord Northcliffe was heard of. And he was one of the ones who came up with the atrocity propaganda against Germany in World War I, if I recall correctly. Marx understood propaganda long before Lord Northcliffe was ever heard of. Effective mass propaganda cannot be too simple. And in the application of this rule, Marx should have received some sort of prize. All history is class war. Life is class war. They have the wealth. Let us take it. Marxism imputed capitalistic instincts to the upper classes and socialistic instincts to the lower classes. This was entirely gratuitous, for Marxism made an appeal to the capitalistic instincts of the lower classes. The upper classes are treated as the competitor who has cornered all the wealth, and the lower classes are invited to take it away from them. This is capitalism. Trade unions are purely capitalistic, distinguished from employers only by the different commodity they purvey. Instead of an article, they sell human labor. Trade unionism is simply a development of capitalistic economy, but it has nothing to do with socialism, for it is simply self-interest. It pits the economic interest of the manual laborers against the economic interest of the employer and a manager. It is simply Malthus in a new company. It is still the old struggle for existence. Man against man, group against group, class against class, everyone against the state. The instinct of socialism, however, absolutely precludes any struggle between the component parts of the organism. It is as hostile to the mistreatment of manual laborers by employers as it is to the shortage of the sabotage of society by class warriors. Capitalism convinces itself that a struggle for existence is organically necessary. Socialism knows that any such struggle is unnecessary and pathological. Between capitalism and socialism, there is no relationship of true and false. Both are instincts and have the same historical rank, but one of them belongs to the past and one to the future. Capitalism is a product of rationalism and materialism and was the ruling force of the 19th century. Socialism is the form of an age of political imperialism, of authority, of historical philosophy, of superpersonal political imperative. It is not at all a matter of terminology or ideals, but a matter of feeling and instinct. The minute we begin to think that a class has responsibilities to another class, we are beginning to think socialistically, no matter what we call our thinking. We may call it Buddhism for all history cares, but we will think that way. If we use the terminology of capitalism and the practice of socialism, no harm is done, for practice and action are what matter in life, not words and names. The only distinction between types of socialism is between efficient and inefficient, weak and strong, timid and bold. A strong, bold, and efficient socialist feeling will, however, hardly use a terminology deriving from an antithetical type of thought, since strong, ascendant, full life is consonant in word and deed. Moving on to Roman numeral 3. Marxism showed its capitalistic provenance in its idea of classes, its idea toward work, and its obsession with economics. Marx was a Jew, and had thus imbibed from his youth the Old Testament idea that work was a curse laid upon man as a result of sin. Free capitalism placed this same value on work, regarding it as something from which to be delivered as a prerequisite to the enjoyment of life. In England, the classic land of capitalism, the ideas of work and wealth were the central ideas of social valuation. The rich had not to work. The middle classes had to work, but were not poor. The poor had to work to exist from one week to the next. Thorsten Veblen, in his Theory of the Leisure Class, showed the wide ramifications in the life of the 19th century nations of this attitude toward work. The whole atmosphere of the Marxian utopia is that the necessity for the proletariat to work will vanish with its victory. After the, quote, expropriation, the proletariat can retire and even have ci-devant employers for servants. I think that means former employers for servants. This attitude toward work is not universal-human, but a thing tied to the existence of English capitalism. Never before in the Western culture was there a prevailing feeling that work should be despised. In fact, after the Reformation, the leading theologians all adopted a positive attitude toward work as a high, if not the highest, value. From this period comes the idea that to work is to pray. This spirit is once again uppermost, and socialistic instincts regards a man's work not as a curse laid upon him, a hated thing from which money can free him, but as the content of his life, the earthly side of his mission in the world. Marxism has the opposite valuation of work from socialism. Similarly, the Marxian concept of class has nothing to do with socialism. The articulation of society in Western culture was at first into estates. Estates were primarily spiritual. As Freidank said in Gothic times, F-R-E-I, Freidank, D-A-N-K, same word, Freidank, said in Gothic times, God has shapen lives three, boor and knight and priest they be. And the fourth estate would be the media, remember. That was from the French Revolution. God hath shapen lives three, boor and knight and priest they be. That'd be, boor would be like farmer, I think. Except it's B-O-O-R, but B-O-E-R, or B-O-A-U-E-R, Bauer, peasant in German. B-O-E-R, boor folk, South African, Dutch Afrikaans. These are not classes, but organic ranks. The priest, the knight, and the peasant. After the French Revolution came the idea that the articulation of society was a reflection of the situation of money hoards. The term class was used to describe an economic layer of society. This term was final for Marx, since life to him was simply economics, saturated as he was with a capitalistic world outlook. But to socialism, money possession is not the determinant of rank in society any more than it is in our army. Social rank in socialism does not follow money, but authority. Thus, socialism knows no classes in the Marxian capitalistic sense. It sees the center of life in politics and has thus a definite military spirit in it. Instead of classes, the expressions of wealth, it has rank, the concomitant of authority. Marxism is equally obsessed with economics as its contemporary English environment. It begins and ends with economics, focusing its gaze on the tiny European peninsula, ignoring the past and present of the rest of the world. It simply wanted to frustrate the course of Western history and chose class war as a technique for doing it. There has been class war before Marxism, but this philosophy gave it a theory which said there was nothing else in the world. There had been jealousy in the lower orders before Marxism, but now this jealousy was given an ethical basis, which made it alone good, and everything above evil. Wealth was branded as immoral and criminal, its possessors as arch-criminals. Class war was a competition, and something more, it was a battle of good against evil, and thus more brutal and unlimited than mere war. Because there's no compromising with the morally evil, the same in the Jewish religion of pseudoscience of Marxism as in Christianity, dealing with slavery, say. Class war was a competition, and something more than it was it was a battle of good against evil, and thus more brutal and unlimited than mere war. To repeat that. Western thinkers like Sorel could not adopt this attempt to make the class war exceed any limitations of honor and conscience. Sorel conceived, S-O-R-E-L, conceived of class war as similar to international war, with protection of non-combatants, rules of warfare, the Catholic theory of just war, honorable treatment of prisoners. Marxism regarded the opponent as a class war criminal. The opponent could not be assimilated into a new system. He was to be exterminated, enslaved, starved, persecuted. And guess who fills that hate category today? The white man. The open season on the white man in the controlled media, which is run by the intellectual and bloodline heirs of Marx. White-hating Jews, Marxists. The Marxist class war concept thus far exceeded politics. Politics is simply power activity, not revenge activity, jealousy, hatred, or justice. Again, it has no connection with socialism, which is a political through and through, and regards a defeated opponent as a member of a new, larger organism with the same rights and opportunities as those already in it. This was one more connection of Marxism with capitalism, for the latter had a tendency to moralize politics, making the opponent into a wicked person. Lastly, Marxism differs from socialism in being a religion, whereas socialism is an instinctive organizatory political principle. He uses these strange compounds, organizatory hyphen political principle. Marxism had its Bible, its saints, its apostles, its heresy tribunals, orthodoxy and heterodoxy, its dogmas and exegesis, sacred writings and schisms. Socialism dispenses with all this. It is interested in procuring cooperation of men with the same instincts. Ideology has even now little importance to socialism, and in the coming decades it will have ever less. As socialism creates the form of the future, Marxism slips into the past with the other remnants of materialism. The mission of Western man is not to become rich through class war, it is to actualize his inner ethico-politico-cultural imperative. To be what we are born to be, in other words. And let's wrap it up right there, because this is very dense stuff, I think, and that's enough to think about for now, a good 42-minute consideration of Marxism. Then we'll be right back again as we start this new spate of recordings with Freudianism next time. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.